Well, you've probably heard that expression, rich as Croesus. Turns out he was a real person who ruled the Lydians from the city of Sardis in what is now western Turkey. Excavations at Sardis are telling us what life was like there 2,000 and more years ago, but raising some mysteries along the way. And with me to perhaps unravel some of those mysteries is UW-Madison art history professor Nick Cahill, who has been the director of the Sardis excavation since 2008. Welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you very much.
I noticed that this excavation at Sardis is actually, under the aegis of Harvard?
Harvard and Cornell were the two co-sponsors when the excavation was begun in 1958 by a Harvard professor, George Hanfmann, and his co-director, Henry Detweiler. Professor Hanfmann retired in 1976 as director, and it was taken over by another professor at the University of California at Berkeley, who was my mentor when I was in school there. And when he retired from the excavation in 2008, then I took over.
Do you know how that original excavation began in 1958? Did the Turks invite people in to actually excavate, or how did it happen?
He applied, and he was following up on the work of an earlier archaeologist who was a professor at Princeton named Howard Crosby Butler. And Butler excavated at Sardis between 1910 and 1914, and the excavations were cut off by the First World War. And then following the First World War, when the Greeks had control of that part of Anatolia, there was one final season, but Butler died before that season, or just after that season had finished. And his work remained unpublished, or some parts of his work remained unpublished. Professor Hanfmann eventually was given the job of publishing the pottery. And at an early stage of his work on this pottery, he thought that if he went back to Sardis for maybe just another month or so, that they could find a little bit more information and solve a few last questions before he published Butler's work. And 57 years later, we're still digging.
How big is the site?
It's about a mile by a mile and a half or so. So it's a large city. It's hard to estimate how much of it we've excavated in the last 50-something years, but it's under 2%. And much of that is only excavated to the top level. And one of the wonderful things about Sardis is that it was inhabited for thousands of years. And so you've got sort of layer upon layer upon layer of civilizations all living in each other's ruins. It's not even the case that they're sort of building on top of one another, but they're reusing each other's – they're reusing the remains of earlier civilizations, repurposing them, taking them apart and putting them together in new and interesting and sort of postmodern ways, which makes it a really fascinating
I would think it would make it rather complicated.
Very complicated,
yes. You have a piece from 500 BC that's then being used for something else in 580.
Precisely, and this happens quite often. And then it's reused and that building falls down and they put it back together slightly differently. And this is something that we become very interested in. And they're doing this all through the history of the site, that even in the earliest or the almost earliest buildings that we find there, they're already reusing pieces of earlier buildings that we don't know where they were.
What makes Sardis such great real estate?
It's got a whole lot of advantages, and one of them is just its natural situation. It's on a natural trade route between the Aegean Sea and central Turkey. So caravans and travel has gone past that site and forever. A second is that it's got a very defensible acropolis, a citadel that was never taken by brute force, by main force. It was always betrayed by somebody else whenever it fell, and it did reasonably frequently. And what made it extra special was that the river that flowed by the foot of this citadel, the Pactolus River, provided so much gold that the Lydians became the wealthiest people in the world. And as you said at the beginning, rich as Croesus,
and we'll get into
became
some,
fabled.
Get into what they did with some of that gold,
yes,
a little later. But we're talking about these various layers of civilization. What do we find first, and how far back does it go?
The last time that Sardis was a real city was in the 7th century AD, so just after the reign of Justinian and some of his followers. And at that time, Sardis and almost every other city in this region undergo a tremendous collapse and are fairly quickly, within a century.
Do we have any idea why?
That's an interesting question. People used to blame invasions from the Arabs or the Persians. We know that there was an invasion in about 616. A question then was, why would they be able to conquer these cities when they couldn't have done that 100 years earlier? We think that there may have been a longstanding drought that profoundly affected the water supply. And we've been doing some recent work on that in the later part of the 6th century. People are digging wells in their houses, and those wells go down 60, 70 feet into the ground.
That would be an indicator.
So they really need water at that point. The Roman water system that was so famous had failed, and people are forced to turn to other sources. We think there's an earthquake at some point in that time, and we've got some interesting new evidence for that, for an earthquake that takes down many of the public buildings there. But that would – Sardis was destroyed by earthquakes many times over its history, and the real question is why they don't recover from this one.
Still digging to find out.
We're still digging to find out. So that's the end of the city. And the beginning of the city is maybe 700 BC or earlier. The earliest remains that we find at the site date to the Bronze Age, the time of the Trojan War, say. And there may be earlier things under that, but we haven't gotten that deep. But it really becomes an important place in something like 700, as I say. And we hear about that from Greek poets. The Greek poet Archilochus tells us about Gyges, and he says, I do not care for Gyges rich in gold. So already the Greeks know that these guys are the richest people in the world, and they're distinguishing themselves, which is one of the interesting things about Sardis.
How was it as a military power then, if you're going to have all of that gold, all those riches, you have to be able to defend it?
They are very strong both offensively and defensively. Their armies conquer – the armies of Gyges and his successor kings conquer the Greek cities along the coast of Asia Minor. They conquer the area around Troy. And we read that the king of Lydia allowed the Greeks to settle on the coast up there at this very, very strategic location, which meant that he wasn't interested in the sea, in the coastline. He was interested in the interior of that area. And what that interior is famous for is gold. So they maybe – I like to think they use the gold that they have at home to finance an imperial expansion to go after a particularly more gold, and that leaves them in control of all of the western half of Turkey, I mean all the way out to the modern Kızıl Irmak, a river that flows down the middle of Turkey.
But the Lydians in that particular situation would be wedged in between a rising Greek power to the west and mm-hmm. the Persians on the east.
They are very much in that role, and they act as this interesting intermediary between the Greeks and the powers of the East. At that time, the Assyrians, the Babylonians, the Medes, these earlier cultures living in what's now Iran. And they have diplomatic relations with both. They wage war against both. They trade. And they're the people whom the Greeks sort of first come in contact with when they move east. So they become sort of paradigms of Eastern potentates, Eastern rulers, fabulously wealthy. The Greeks have all kinds of interesting ideas about the sort of gender roles of people in the East. And they later on, the Greeks talk about Persians as being sort of effeminate. They don't do masculine things like compete in the Olympic Games naked, for instance. They wear clothes. They don't get suntanned. They aren't physically fit in the same way that the Greeks are. And that's something that they – That sort of effeminacy is something they put on the Lydians as well, and they've got all kinds of crazy stories about Lydian sort of sexual habits and things that they very different from the Greeks, and it's a way again of distinguishing themselves from these people who were richer, more powerful, in many ways more cultured, were great patrons of the Greeks. They build sanctuaries to the Greeks. They dedicate treasures that the Greeks couldn't possibly imagine. The Gyges dedicates 15 tons of gold or something at the sanctuary at Delphi, and Croesus, the final king of that dynasty, contributes much, much more. And these treasures, great bricks of gold that were 6 palms long and 1 palm wide and 3 palms thick or something, that must have weighed, you know,
because gold
200
is heavy.
Kilos.
Gold is dense, yeah.
200 kilograms, one brick, and he dedicated 117 of these things. The weights don't come out correctly, but it was a fabulous amount of gold, something no Greek could possibly hope to dedicate. And yet they see these people as foreign and as somehow inferior to them because they are foreign and they're not civilized in the same way.
Well, what about the Lydian culture, the language, for example, for starters?
The language is not terribly well known because we don't have enough of it. We've only got 115 or so inscriptions, and a lot of those are only a word long. It's an Anatolian language related to Hittite, Indo-European language related to Hittite. Most of the inscriptions that we have are either very formulaic gravestones, so we know the word for tomb and, you know, do not disturb. The longer ones that are interesting are very difficult to read because we don't have enough.
You don't have the Rosetta Stone.
We don't have the Rosetta Stone, no. The culture is an interesting mixture of things that are similar to Greek. Greek Lydian pottery, for instance, becomes similar to Greek. Lydian sculpture becomes – they adopt many of the sculptural sort of styles of Greek sculpture.
The same degree of skill?
Very much so, yes. They're great builders. They're great sculptors. There's much less of it. And if you think we've got many, many Greek cities and we've been digging them for many years, we've got one Lydian city and we've only been digging it for 50. So there's much, much less known about them. But particularly in recent years, we've been learning a great deal about their technologies, their building abilities. They're very forward in their use, for instance, of bricks. They're the first people to use fired brick in this part of the world. It's a technology maybe they learn from the Assyrians, and they bring it to the Aegean. Nobody uses fired brick in this part of the world, and again, for 500 years until the Romans come along.
So they were ahead of the game in some ways.
Very much.
And as far as comparing the Lydians, say, to the Trojans, I mean, they're fairly close together geographically, fairly close together chronologically.
There's a gap in there. And the famous period of Troy is the Bronze Age, and that comes to an end around the time or a little bit after the time of the Trojan War. And then there is a sort of a dark age, and nobody likes to use that word nowadays. But it does see the end of sort of settled urbanism, of monumental arts and monumental architecture, probably a great decline in population for a number of hundred years between the period when Troy was great and the period when Sardis begins to be great. And Sardis and that end of the Trojans, for instance, also brings down the Hittites, who were the great power in this part of the world, and the New Kingdom of Egypt and the Mycenaean Greeks. All of those civilizations are closely intertwined and come to an end in the 12th century B.C. or the end of the 12th century B.C. And then it's not until the 8th century B.C. so about 700 or a little bit after, that we see real settled urbanism, monumental architecture, a lot of long-distance trade, a lot of writing in this part of the world. It's a slow process. But the Lydians are there in that sort of second wave after the great period of Troy.
So the Lydians were fairly successful militarily in their best years?
They are the great conquerors of this part of the world, and they conquer all the cities or most of the cities along the Greek coast. We know much less about their conquests inland, and they seem to have gone as far as Mesopotamia. They send emissaries to the king of Ashurbanipal, to the king of Assyria. And he says that these people come from so far away they couldn't even find a translator for their language. He was in the same situation that we are. They conquer Gordion, which was the citadel, the city of Midas of the Golden Touch. And we find Lydian coins and Lydian pottery and Lydian objects at Gordion. They seem to use that as a sort of a capital, a regional capital. So they are great. They're great warriors, and they were particularly – their cavalry was particularly fearsome. They had – there's a story in which Croesus, having conquered all the Greeks along the coast, he looks to building ships, and he asks one of the Greek philosophers, and the name differs in different versions of the story. He says, you know, how should I go about building ships, building a navy? And the philosopher says, oh, that's really great, because the islanders, the Greek islanders, are putting together an army to attack Lydia. And Croesus says, oh, that's terrific. You know, our cavalry will knock them flat on the ground. We'll just blow them over. And this philosopher says, well, that's what the islanders are saying about your navy. So they were very good on land, but they had no particular interest in naval power, which is where the Greeks excelled.
Well, it sounded as if they had plenty to take over inland. I mean, plenty of wealth.
Yes, yes, very much so.
Couldn't necessarily go in both directions at once. As far as Croesus and the Lydian Empire, let's call it, was he really the zenith of Lydian civilization?
Him and his father, Aliates, were the two kings that we know most about and who under whom the empire extended most widely all the way out into central Turkey, as I say. And they had dynastic marriages with people in the Near East, with the Babylonians and with the Medes in Iran. And Croesus had this court where he invited Solon, the wise man from Athens, and another Athenian rich man named Alcmaeon, who came and helped him arrange things at Delphi. When Croesus wanted to make dedications at Delphi, Alcmaeon came, and Croesus wanted to thank him and said, why don't you go to my treasury and take away all the gold you can carry? So Alcmaeon had special clothes made with pockets, and he filled his hat, and he sprinkled the gold in his hair and so forth, and he waddled out, hardly able to walk. And Croesus was so amused by this that he gave him twice as much, and that became told him to take away twice that much gold, and that became the origin of one of the most famous families in Athens, the Alcmaeonidae.
Did Croesus then – well, let me put it this way. What happened – after Croesus, once we reach this pinnacle of success for the Lydians?
Croesus overreaches himself. And in Iran, a new king arises, Cyrus, recently the Cyrus Cylinder just traveled around the United States, the sort of first Bill of Rights. So Cyrus overthrew the reigning power in Iran, who are the Medes. And they're related, as I said, to the Lydians by marriage. So Croesus wants to avenge himself, and also to avenge his family, and also to expand his empire. So he attacks Cyrus. He first goes to Delphi and asks them what he should do. And Delphi says, if you cross the river, the Halys River, you will destroy a great empire. And so Croesus, who's rich but dumb, takes off, attacks the Persians, has a battle with them, which is a draw, and it's the end of the campaigning season, and so he goes home. And Cyrus, who is fast and smart, follows him and doesn't play by the rules. He doesn't wait until the following spring when he should be attacking, but besieges Sardis and captures Croesus. And the story goes, puts him on a funeral pyre, and Croesus at the last minute sort of calls out to the god Apollo and says, you know, why have you betrayed me? What went wrong? You promised me that I would win. And Cyrus wants to put out the fire but can't. But Apollo takes pity on Croesus, sends a rain cloud to put the funeral pyre out. And Cyrus adopts him as sort of a trusted advisor.
Which I've never heard of anything else in history that worked that way.
No. It's no.
That kind of sticks out like a sore thumb when
you read
that.
It's a great story, though, isn't it? Yes.
There's a kind of a tragic story about Croesus's son, too, isn't there?
Yes, it was foretold that he would be killed by weapons, by iron weapons, and so he made his son live without weapons, would not let him go hunting, would not let him go to war. Again, this is an interesting sort of — I don't think any of these stories are real, but they reflect the Greek understanding or the Greek sort of image of these effeminate, powerful and yet effeminate Lydians who don't wage war. And then his son is accidentally killed hunting by a guest friend of his who throws a spear at this wild boar, misses, and kills Croesus' son instead.
So not great warriors by reputation. We'll find out what happened to Sardis under the Persians once they took it over from the Lydians right after this. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with my guest, Nick Cahill, who's in charge of the excavations of the ancient city of Sardis, which went through a procession of owners, you might say, from the Lydians to the Persians after Croesus made the mistake of attacking the forces of the Persian King Cyrus. And Cyrus actually then becomes the owner of the property there, Sardis and the surroundings. And from an archaeological standpoint, what is the significance once the Persians take over?
Well, we've been really lucky in excavating a lot of the destruction level from when Cyrus captured the city. And there's nothing that archaeologists love more than a great destruction, an earthquake or, you know, a volcano like Vesuvius or something. It sort of gives you a time capsule in which lots and lots of things are abandoned exactly or more or less as they were being used. And so we've been excavating houses with all of their pottery, all their food, still in place, burned on the floors. You find pots full of barley and chickpeas,
really?
Garlic. We found a clove, a whole head of garlic burned. It's just carbon.
From like 2,500 years ago.
From 2,500
wow.
years ago, from 547 BC. And this gives you this wonderful view of how people were living at a particular moment in time, what they ate, how much meat they ate, for instance. The Greeks ate very little meat. The Lydians seem to have eaten an awful lot of it, to judge from animal bones and spits that are found in houses. Manufacture. They manufacture a rare kind of glass that's otherwise found only in the Near East, only in Nimrud and places. And we found the people and skeletons of soldiers and civilians who were butchered in the final capture of the city. And you find these skeletons of young men who are in their 20s, their left arms, the two of them that we found so far, left arms are more developed because they carry these heavy shields.
Sure.
And their right arms more with more freedom of motion because they're using a spear or a sword. One of them we excavated had spurs on his ankles from walking too far. He must have had terrible tendonitis or something from recent walking. And then he had broken ribs that had partly healed for 4 to 6 weeks before he was finally killed. And I sort of imagine that this is one of Croesus' soldiers who walked all the way from Sardis to this battle in central Turkey where he was wounded in the battle with Cyrus, had to walk back. And if you've ever broken ribs, it's very, very painful. Had to walk back to Sardis, which is maybe, you know, 400 miles or so, and then was finally killed. And when he was killed, he broke both bones of his forearm, fending off some blow from above. And then there are either two or three cuts on his head from two different weapons, and he finally died of a broken neck.
Wow, so he must have been a heck of a fighter.
Heck of a fighter, these guys were, yes. So you get this remarkable detailed view of how people were living at this moment at the height of this empire when suddenly it all came to an end. And then the interesting thing is that we get nothing. And we know that Sardis under the Persians was the capital of one of the most important satrapies, one of the most important provinces of the Persian Empire. It was governed by brothers and relatives of the great king. It was the mustering point for when the Persians invaded Greece. It was a really important place. But archaeologically, there's this gap. and we find nothing datable between in much of the city, between this final destruction in 547 in the Hellenistic period when Sardis had been conquered now by Alexander the Great, and he turns it into a Greek polis.
Sounds like it was just used as some kind of a campground before the Greeks developed it.
Something like that, yes, that the Persians come, they convert it to an administrative capital and a military capital, but not a city. And maybe that's a sort of attempt at control, that the Lydians were a famous warlike people and caused the Persians lots of problems. They were, you know, great fighters, and they'd held out against the Persians, and they revolted against the Persians, and they had sources of gold and deep resources. And my theory at the moment is that in order to control this powerful city, they effeminized it in a way. They emasculated it, which is what the Greeks always talk about too. That they defortify it, they take the population and they either enslave them or kill them or take them back to Iran, or they spread them out in the countryside into little villages. There's a wonderful story in which after Croesus is spared from being burned, he sees and then the Persians go away, and the Lydians almost immediately revolt. And Cyrus says to Croesus, you know, what should I do with these guys? They're just going to cause me no end of trouble. Should I just kill them all and enslave them? And Croesus says, no, don't do that. Take away their weapons, make them wear soft shoes, and teach them to play musical instruments, and make them into shopkeepers. And then they will be like women instead of men, and they won't cause you any more trouble. So, again, there's this interesting interplay between men and women and Greek and barbarian, and the Lydians being sort of, although they're warlike, being sort of moved into the sphere of women.
Did Alexander the Great take the place then?
He did. They didn't fight back. They simply, when they saw him coming, they just gave up, and they sent a couple of embassies out, one from the Persians and one from the Lydians, and they gave him the keys to the city basically.
And then, but he actually did some building?
And then he did, or maybe a little bit later, they start a program to convert this sort of local Near Eastern capital city into a Greek polis. And so you need things like a theater. You need temples. They build a tremendous temple of Artemis on the site of an earlier sanctuary.
That's the equivalent of Diana, the goddess of the hunt and chastity and...
Yes.
Things wild, too, I guess.
Things wild. We don't know what Artemis at Sardis was like. The same name can be applied to many different goddesses. And the Artemis of Sardis, it turns out from a very recent discovery of a gravestone in Istanbul that was found under a railway station recently. She's a very weird-looking creature indeed. And doesn't look human at all. So I don't know what she was like, whether she was – you could think of her as the goddess of the hunt, or whether she's a local deity whom the Greeks sort of – with the similar name, whom the Greeks sort of combined with their Artemis.
But the Greeks are building temples?
The Greeks are building temples. It's the fourth largest Ionic temple in the world. They began a beautiful, beautiful building. Still two columns have been standing since antiquity, and used over many, many years, converted by the Romans. The Romans cut it in half and convert half of it into a temple of the imperial cult. So we found statues of maybe half a dozen emperors and their wives in the wreckage of this building. And these statues were 40-something feet high.
Oh.
Big, big standing statues, one head in the British Museum, another head that we found a few years ago, others found by Butler and people.
And the Romans, you mentioned earthquakes before. The Romans did have some earthquake problems from time to time.
There was a terrible earthquake that demolished the city completely in 17. And the Lydians sent to the Roman Emperor Tiberius, and they made a plea to rebuild their city, in part based on a shared connection. The Lydians were said to be the ancestors of the Etruscans. And they say, you know, we've got this connection with Italy, so you should help us rebuild our city. And he did, and he's called the founder of the city, and the Rome and the Lydians renamed, or the Sardians renamed themselves the Caesarian Sardians in honor of the Romans. They build a huge temple of the imperial cult separate from the Temple of Artemis, and that's a place where we've been excavating recently and finding really interesting material.
And then does it, before we get into some of those artifacts, does it pretty much end with the Romans in terms of its urban basis?
It undergoes a great sort of second flowering in late antiquity, about 400 or so, with the coming of Christianity and the end of paganism, interestingly enough. And there are great new streets being built and great buildings. They add sort of a shopping mall at part of the city. They convert previous temples. The temple of Cybele, who's the native Anatolian goddess, convert that into they take that apart, and they use the pieces in a new synagogue that takes place in the Roman bath gymnasium complex. And somehow the Jews at that time, Sardis has had a powerful Jewish population for many hundreds of years at that point, and they're able to buy up a big piece of public real estate and convert it into a magnificent, the largest synagogue in the ancient world, paved with 1,500 square meters of mosaics and wall panels and inscriptions recording the dedications of these different parts of the building. And in this, they reuse the pieces of the earlier mother goddess, the temple of the mother goddess.
Then after that, it pretty much, for these mysterious reasons that you mentioned, maybe drought, maybe earthquakes, maybe a combination of factors, it just falls into disuse.
Goes into decline and is you know, it's covered over by landslides and accumulation. The road, interestingly, remains the same. And one of the wonderful things about Sardis is that there are these continuities in the road that led through the Lydian city. We excavated a gate in the Lydian city of about the time of Homer, 700 BC, and so we know where the main road into that city went. It's right under the Roman road, and that is right under the Izmir Ankara highway, or very close
still
to
the
it.
Way
so
in.
2,700 years of constant. That this was one of the main thoroughfares.
I think it's interesting that even as late as World War I, even though the city was long gone, this was still considered a strategic point.
It's a powerful citadel. It couldn't be taken. And this was as far inland as – or this was the site of a major battle and a sort of a border zone between the Greek forces, the Greek invasion of Anatolia, and the Turkish forces under Ataturk. And we – regularly find bullets and so and other debris from the battles, slit trenches dug into the hills from the battles that were fought there.
We'll look more specifically at what Nick Cahill and his cohorts are digging up at Sardis when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Nick Cahill. He's a UW-Madison art history professor. He's also in charge of the excavations at Sardis, an ancient site, a citadel in what is now western Turkey, which has gone through a series of owners, you might say occupants, the Lydians and the Persians and the Greeks and the Romans, and then a long period in which it pretty much lay fallow, except for the occasional archaeologist, I suppose. Now, you mentioned that getting back to Croesus, being rich as Croesus, and he was sort of the pinnacle of the Lydian phase of Sardis, that they had a lot of gold.
Mm-hmm.
And you mentioned gold bricks, but what point do actual coins come into the picture?
Ancient writers tell us, a number of different ancient writers tell us, that the Lydians invented coinage, and the earliest coins that we find have often Lydian inscriptions on them. So that seems pretty certain, and it seems it's one of the only things that the Lydians have left for modern civilization. We don't read about them, or we don't do much with them.
Are they gold coins?
Except for that. The earliest coins are not made of gold. They're made of a mixture of gold and silver called electrum. And I'm told by geologists that gold occurs naturally, normally mixed with a certain proportion of silver. And what had always been thought is that the Lydians mint coins in part because this mixture is uncertain or unpredictable. Up until then, the Near East had used a system of weighed silver. And if you wanted to buy something, it would cost a certain number of shekels of silver. A shekel is not a coin. It's a weight, and you just weigh the stuff out. And that works fine because everybody knows what silver is worth. But electrum, if it contains more gold, it's worth a lot more than if it contains less gold. So what the Lydians seem to add to this is a sort of a state guarantee that this electrum has a certain purity, and the way that you guarantee that is by stamping it with a symbol of the state. And part of that is that they develop a very sophisticated technology for separating electrum into gold, into pure gold and pure silver, and for refining and specifying exactly what the proportion of electrum is. So although natural electrum varies a lot, Lydian coins are very standard. So you could really guarantee that it contains a certain amount of gold and is worth a certain amount.
So the weight of the coins was standard too?
The weight of the coins and the proportion and the composition. And we've done a couple of years ago, we found in 2008 and 2009, we found two electrum coins, the first ones that we found at Sardis. One of them was found by a graduate student in the classics department here.
Give him an A.
Pardon me?
Give that graduate student an A.
I do, regularly. And he is writing now on the sector in which was excavated this early refinery, the earliest
gold. Is that where he found it? Was actually in a refinery?
It was not, actually. He found it on the Acropolis of Sardis in a trench, a sort of a ruined building. It seems to be a robber's trench where there had been a building, and they ripped it out and then threw all the junk back. And they found – we found a couple of coins. There may have been others. But one of the interesting things that we learned from analyzing these coins – we took them to the 9th of September University in Izmir and had a metallurgist examine them with a scanning electron microscope. And we learned that not only are the composition very standard, but that they had been sort of cooked after they had been minted. So you start with a composition that's only about 55% gold. But the Lydians not only could refine gold, but they had a system in which you could cook the coins and remove the silver from just a very thin layer on the outside and make it look like it had a lot more gold in it than it actually does. So that, you know, like modern coins, a modern quarter is mostly copper with a thin layer of more precious metal on it. The very first coins are something like the same thing. they're in part a token currency, or they don't have as much metal as they're theoretically worth.
What were the images on the coins?
There are lions. The commonest type has a lion on it. Sometimes you have two lions facing one another, but there are many, many, many types of these coins, hundreds of types. And we don't always know who minted them. It was not only the Lydians. The Greeks minted them too. Many sort of local dynasts may have minted coins. There's the Lydian state, but there's lots of sort of independent actors at this time, people who control a small piece of territory and maybe use coinage as a means of control or a statement about their authority over this area.
You mentioned that you found skeletons. Of course, you talked about the warriors with those remarkable wounds that tell stories in themselves. But what about women and children?
Well, while we're on the subject of warriors, one of those fallen warriors had a tiny silver coin right next to his skull. And I've always wondered whether he carried it in his mouth, which people did at the time without pockets. It was before pockets. Or it might have been in a bag around his neck. But I like the idea of going into battle with a coin in your mouth, just in case. Women and children, we don't find the skeletons nearly as much. We learn a lot about how women lived from the remains from their houses, cooking and grinding in the days before mechanical flour mills, for instance. All grinding had to be done by hand. I mean, we start with wheat, and you have to grind it with just simple, very simple grindstones that you move back and forth. And this would take somebody, modern archaeologists who were not very good at it, I'm sure, estimate that it could take four hours or more to grind every day. To grind the grain for your family.
That's what they call the daily grind.
It is the daily grind, and it had a profound effect on women's skeletons, for instance, that it causes, you know, all kinds of
arthritis kind of
problems in their joints, in their knees, that you see in women's skeletons and not in men's. They were great weavers, and we find the remains of weaving equipment in all the houses that we've excavated. It's a little difficult to tell the division of labor in Lydian houses. We don't have quite as many as we would like, but we're trying to find more.
You have a sense of the diet. You mentioned wheat. You mentioned beef rather than fish, which I suppose would have been favored by the seagoing Greeks.
Mm-hmm. Sheep and goats, chickpeas. They were famous for different kinds of spices and for a kind of sort of bread soup that they made with lots of fat and spices in it. They ate puddings. They certainly drank wine, and they may well have drunk beer as well. And,
really?
The Greeks are sort of a wine culture. Central Anatolia is really a beer culture, and they drank beer out through soda straws.
Oh, really?
Yes, because there was junk floating in it, apparently.
Oh, so it was a kind of a filter.
There's a filter, exactly. And we find vessels at Sardis that have filters, have sort of built-in filters, and we think that that is for because they use them for beer. We've done residue analysis, but it hasn't been conclusive yet. And so they may have taken the best of both worlds, having both wine and beer. We find what seem to be ritual dinners with a little cooking pot and a plate and a jug for wine and a mug for drinking or a cup for drinking and an iron knife. And in the cooking pot are the bones of a small puppy.
Oh.
And we found 30 or 40 of those so far. And they seem to be ritual deposits involved with perhaps, you know, the foundation of a building or something. It's not quite clear what they're for.
Is that the only evidence you have of them eating dogs?
It is. But there is, yes, it is. And we don't know whether, obviously they didn't seem to eat these. They buried them. But they are a strange, strange people.
Well, again, you're talking, of course, a big sweep of time, too, where customs come and go.
Customs come and go,
mix
exactly.
And change and all of that. Do you have a sense of the lifespan of these people?
Some of them could certainly live into their 60s and 70s. We have found skeletons of older men who could live that long. Most of the skeletons that we have are of younger people, and many of them died of – we don't have a lot of skeletons, I should say. The ones who died of unnatural causes because they'd been bludgeoned to death or something are one thing. But the life expectancy typically of men in the ancient world would be significantly greater than women who – often died in childbirth or from complications following that, and were often less well-nourished than men. That's something we know from the Greeks, but not so much from the Lydians, just because we don't have that skeletal population.
Do you have a sense that that difference is because of the emphasis on the military?
Well, men throughout so much of history had a higher status and ate first and were simply better fed, yes. One of the, you know, that inequality has been with us for, you know, almost since the dawn of time.
Is it pretty much an agrarian-based culture, or do we see a lot of hunting too?
They do hunt, and Croesus, of course, lost his son to the hunt. There's lots of wild animals in the hills, and we do find bones of deer and other wild animals. But a lot of the meat that they ate would be sheep and goats and pigs. Fewer cows, probably some cows.
But raised wheat.
Raised wheat, raised barley, raised chickpeas and other kinds of lentils that they ate. So a fairly simple but, you know, nutritious nutritious diet, probably not all that bad.
Of the skeletons that you do have, are they pretty much a homogeneous population, or do you see evidence of a lot of cultural cross currents, given that this was on the trade route?
That's so difficult to tell. From the skeletons, it's difficult to tell because we don't have enough of them. And, you know, things like DNA analysis has not been done. We do have inscriptions, so we know a little bit about the language that people were speaking. And there's a wide variety of languages being spoken there, not only Lydian, but Greek and Carian and another form of Lydian that we don't understand. And later on, Aramaic. When the Persians come, we have Aramaic being spoken. We've got Old Persian being spoken, or being used at least. So it's really a melting pot. And there's a marvelous inscription from a nearby site, Ephesus, which lists a bunch of people who are condemned to death for sacrilege. And from the names and other evidence there, you can see this wide variety of people who were all condemned to death sort of uniformly. And there was from the Persian period, there was a Jewish population as well.
Is that unusual?
It's probably more unusual. It is probably unusual, yes, that there's an unusually strong Jewish population. There's one tradition that Sephardim or Sepharad is the name of Sardis, which it is. Oh. I mean, Sparta in the name of Sardis in Persian is Sparta. In Lydian, it's something like Sephard, and that word may have come into use as Sephardim.
Do we have any kind of idea, given all these layers, as to what kind of urban planning might have been involved in any of these iterations of Sardis?
That's something I've been particularly interested in and working on. And the urban plan of Sardis seems to be established at the very beginning from the Lydians. And as I said, people live in these ruins and sort of develop within a system that's set out very early on. And part of this is done through sort of royal buildings that they take natural terraces of this citadel and they encase them in great vertical limestone and sandstone walls, and they sort of regularize the landscape. They develop the landscape in a way that no other civilization had done up in that area up until that time. They've got these magnificent sort of overweening ambitions about transforming the natural landscape in these terraces. And that system is very regular, and we find Lydian and later buildings conforming to the outlines and to the orientations that are established in these terraces over a wide area of the city. And then that system is adopted by the Hellenistic builders and by Roman builders, and it's still in use in the field systems of the farmers who farm the land now.
Tombs?
There are cemeteries at the site, but the most impressive thing at Sardis, and this is what Herodotus tells us as well when he visited the place in the 5th century, he says there's not much to see at Sardis nowadays, and this I think is because the Persians had depopulated the place, except for the tumulus of Aliates. And he says that this is a mound. He gives dimensions for it, which are pretty exact. He says that it was built by the storekeepers and by the artisans and by the prostitutes of Sardis, and that they each contributed, and that when you add it up, it was all written up on inscriptions on the top, and that the prostitute share was the largest part. Again, the Greeks have these very weird ideas about Eastern sexuality and stuff, and I don't believe a word of it, but the mound is there. It's 360 meters in diameter, which is wider than the Great Pyramid at Giza is only 270 meters in diameter. And I think it was meant to rival these great works of the civilizations.
This was visible then. It wasn't underground.
It's a mound of earth, more than 1,000 feet wide, still standing, 60 meters high, so 200 and something feet high. And it's just earth. Herodotus says that it was encircled by a wall, by a retaining wall, but that wall doesn't survive.
So there was actually nothing in this huge
tomb. A chamber. There's a marble chamber that you can get into. It had been looted by the Romans, And then in 1853, the Prussian ambassador in Smyrna went out there, and he drove a tunnel into it and found these Roman tunnels and made his way into the chamber, which he found looted. And you can still go in there. It's a little scary. The tunnels are only a foot high in places, so you have to wriggle on your...
Scary after the first 500 feet or so.
Yes, it is scary. But the chamber is gorgeous. It's beautifully, beautifully finished. And it had been looted in antiquity, but there are other... There's maybe 115 or so of these tombs. Aliates is the biggest. There's three really big ones, though. And the third of them, the smallest of them, was chosen by Professor Hanfmann, the first excavator, the first director of this excavation, for research. And he spent 3 years tunneling in this mound and sent a tunnel into the center and then did various passages around. We went back a couple of years ago and did a geophysical survey using modern remote sensing techniques and found a wild anomaly, a wonderful anomaly, the big bright red spot on the map that showed up in three different techniques using ground-penetrating radar and electrical resistance tomography and magnetometer. All of them showed a great anomaly at this same point. So I took a year off. I took a leave of absence from the university, I got a grant from the graduate school to partly finance this. I took a sabbatical. We took a small team to and stayed on after the regular season ended. We had to rebuild the original shoring that had been built in the 1960s, which was made of wood then and had rotten completely and was very dangerous itself. But the tunnels were fine. We redid the shoring with steel. We put in a new railway. We put in, air pumps and lots of infrastructure, and found absolutely nothing. It was such a disappointment.
Like Capone's vault, only a lot worse.
Yeah. And, we put a lot of faith in science, and it's not always right.
Well, we literally just scratched the surface of this excavation or ongoing set of excavations at Sardis. But Nick Cahill, thanks for joining me.
Thank you very much.
I'm Norman Gilliland, and I hope you can be listening for the next hour of University of the Air.